Hey everybody, today on the program we talk about Freethought Day, we talk about the rise of the nuns, we talk about a neuroscientist who quote-unquote went to heaven, and we talk about human rights. Remember, Jesus loves each and every one of us, and we only hurt the ones we love. You're listening to the San Diego Seculars for Monday, October 15th, 2012. Hi everyone, you're listening to the San Diego Seculars. My name is Jason Fry, the president of the Humanist Association of San Diego. So to start off, I wanted to wish a happy Navaratri to our Hindu friends out there. Navaratri, of course, is the nine-day Hindu festival celebrating three goddesses, Durga, Lakshmi, and Saraswati. Saraswati is the goddess of knowledge. Go figure. In Christendom, in Islam, in Judaism, they go celebrating the god of war, violence, and guilt. But the Hindus celebrate the goddess of knowledge. What a wonderful day, celebrating knowledge. Hey, Christians, you might want to go pick that one up. You know, there's still, 100 shopping days till Christmas. Put knowledge, celebrating knowledge, on your calendar. Anyway, so some cool things today. I want to talk about some news, and I want to go into human rights. And after our little chat, I want to tell you about some cool things coming up with the Humanist Association. And so, to start off, if you're dyslexic or you have a dyslexic loved one, you might want to check into this. From Open Dyslexic, there is a new app created by Abelardo Gonzalez. It is a new font that has heavy bottomed letters to help try to minimize flipping or rearrangement of letters and words. And this font is gaining in popularity, and last week it appeared in Instapaper. So check it out. It's from Open Dyslexic. If you yourself are dyslexic, are dyslexic or know someone else who is, please tell them about this. I fortunately am not dyslexic, so I don't know the struggles that dyslexic people face, but, you know, I think this is wonderful. Anything we can do to help everyone have equal social participation, you know, I'm going to get to that in the human rights portion. Also, something unique, an 8-pound, 9-ounce baby girl was born in Iowa on 10-11-12 at 1:14 in the afternoon, so the numbers lined up 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14. The girl's name was Layla Fitzgerald. Congratulations to her parents. And I just thought that was unique. You know, the numerologist must be loving this one. But I thought this was absolutely unique to have a baby born 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. And, you know, we can always find numbers like that if we go looking for them. But interesting. On top of that, being cited as carrying out with 60 years of relative peace, as opposed to the generations and age-old conflicts, the Nobel Association awarded its annual Peace Prize to the European Union. The European Union was established in 1951 with a total of 6 countries. Today, there are 27 countries in the European Union. The Nobel Prize started off with 5 different prizes, and we've added a couple more since 1901. The Nobel Prizes include peace, chemistry, math, medicine and physiology, literature, physics, and economics. And the European Union won despite anti-austerity protests. And interesting to note, we've had 4 U.S. presidents and 1 vice president to win the Peace Prize. Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, League of Nations for Woodrow Wilson, Jimmy Carter, and Barack Obama. Al Gore won the Nobel Peace Prize, and he was the vice president. On top of that, Henry Kissinger won the Peace Prize to helping end a war that he helped prolong. And it's interesting thinking that rather than just a couple people or one specific person, that an entire political body of composed of different nations won the prize. And some thoughts that we had circulating around at Coffee and Conversation the other night, Mickey brought up the fact that this could technically be considered a prospective peace award, because right now the idea of the European Union is being rocked by austerity measures and a bad global economy. So perhaps this could be a unifying element to keeping it well together. And then somebody, Rob, asked an interesting question. He said, who gets the award? How do they divvy up the prize? Interesting, huh? And then lastly, thinking about this for unique distributions of accolades, I guess you could call it. In 2006, if you remember, there was a shiny mirror on the cover, and Time's Person of the Year was you. It was me. It was you. It was all of us. And that's because of social networking. So congratulations, Europe. Keep up the peace, and let's try to get that austerity under control. And then also, marking a letter from former Massachusetts Governor William Phipps in 1692, trying to call an end to the Salem witch trials, we celebrate Freethought Day. Freethought Day, commemorating that day on the 12th of October, 1692. And it's interesting to think about the Salem witch trials, especially during this time of year, Halloween, thinking about The Crucible by Arthur Miller. And the Salem witch trials lasted from 1692 to 1693, and no person was burned at the stake. There were 19 people hanged, and one person, an octogenarian by the name of Giles Corey, was pressed to death under heavy stones for refusing to even participate in such abhorrent, ridiculous kangaroo courts. And when we think about the witch trials, we have to think about things like the fact that in these situations, Christianity and Islam have had their share of witch trials. Even today, in Uganda, for example, there are people being burned at the stake for witchcraft. In Saudi Arabia, we have people being arrested and prosecuted for being witches. We had, I think his name was Ali Hussein Sabat. I don't know what's happening with him now, but he was a Lebanese TV personality, a TV psychic in Lebanon. And Ali Sabat was arrested and prosecuted. I think that they reduced his sentence down from death, but he was given a sentence of capital punishment for being a witch. There are no witches out there. It still happens to this day. It's insane. It's absolutely insane. And this partially extends back to this whole biblical passage back in Exodus from Moses that said, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. And these issues are still with us today. You know, for example, in Pakistan, where there was a 14-year-old girl who was a brave and courageous activist standing up for her right to an education, and she was shot in the head by the Taliban. And she luckily survived. I don't know what's happening with her now, but a girl wanted to go and obtain an education, and she was shot in the head for speaking out about her right to step up and be part of humanity and receive that education. And it just really makes me mad. I am mad when I hear things like this. It's awful. And then we have to hear that crap about cultural relativism. Well, you know what? I'm going to put my foot down at least and say, screw cultural relativism. If a girl wants to go to school, she's going to go to school. We need to stand up for that, not these ideas of this disproportionate social hierarchical worth between men and women, where women in certain cultures are construed still as chattel, where women in certain cultures still have to submit to their husbands, where women in certain cultures, it is seen as a crime or socially irresponsible for a woman to pick up a book, to read, to learn. It's reprehensible. It's, as Hillary Clinton said in her speech to the UN against crimes against gays and lesbians and crimes against women, she said, violence against women is not culture, it's a crime. So violence and intimidation against women who are pursuing education or trying to be equal members of society is not culture. It is a crime, and I will shout till my voice bleeds to the last day on that. And I think you should too. It's insane. It's insane when we have certain social endorsements towards these types of behaviors. And then we have situations where we have expectations, religious expectations that judges in this country have granted above spousal abuse. In New Jersey, for example, a couple years ago, there was a case in which a woman sued her husband for spousal rape. And he was Muslim, and the judge in that case said that his religion granted him the right to expect sex whenever and wherever he wanted. Luckily, when it was appealed, the case was overturned. The decision was overturned. But still, it pisses me off. And I don't know. I don't know what to say about it. Maybe I should write a book about violence against women in religion. And I don't know, maybe I'm not the right person to do this only because I wouldn't have the gravitas of a woman writing it, because I don't know. I guess I'm rambling at this point, but a great book to read on this, one of my favorite books, look up Ayaan Hirsi Ali's Infidel. You guys, if you haven't read it, you have to read it. It's a tale of courage, it's wonderful, and you guys will absolutely love it. Well, speaking of it being Free Thought Day, I wanted to go a little bit into Mark Twain. And in Christopher Hitchens' book, The Portable Atheist, there are selections from Twain. And these parts come out of From Europe and Elsewhere and A Pen Warmed Up in Hell. And from Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, he writes, "Religion had its share in the changes of civilization and national character, of course. What share? The lions. In the history of the human race, this has always been the case, will always be the case, to the end of time, no doubt, or at least until man, by the slow process of evolution, shall develop into something really fine and high, some billions of years hence, say. The Christian Bible is a drugstore. Its contents remain the same, but the medical practice changes. For 1800 years, these changes were slight, scarcely noticeable. The practice was allopathic in its rudest and crudest form. The dull and ignorant physician day and night, and all the days and all the nights, drenched his patient with vast and hideous doses of the most repulsive drugs to be found in the store's stock. He bled him, cupped him, purged him, puked him, salivated him, never gave his system a chance to rally nor nature a chance to help. He kept him religious sick for 18 centuries and allowed him not a well day during that time. The stock in the store was made up about equal portions of baleful and debilitating poisons and healing and comforting medicines. But the practice of the time confined the physician to the use of the former. By consequence, he could only damage his patient, and that is what he did. Not until far within our century was any considerable change in the practice introduced, and then mainly in effect only in Great Britain and the United States. In the other countries today, the patient either still takes the ancient treatment or does not call the physician at all. In the English-speaking countries, the changes observable in our century were forced by that very thing just referred to, the revolt of the patient against the system. They were not projected by the physician. They were not projected by the physician. The patient fell to doctoring himself, and the physician's practice began to fall off. He modified his method to get back to his trade. He did it gradually, reluctantly, and never yielded more at a time than the pressure compelled. At first, he relinquished the daily dose of hell and damnation and administered it every other day. Only next, he allowed another day to pass, then another, and presently another, when he had restricted it at last to Sundays and imagined that now there would surely be a truce, the homeopath arrived on the field and made him abandon hell and damnation together and administered Christ's love and comfort and charity and compassion in its stead. These have been in the drugstore all the time, gold-labeled and conspicuous among the long shelf-loads of repulsive purges and vomits and poisons. And so the practice was to blame that they had remained unused, not in the pharmacy. To the ecclesiastical physician of 50 years ago, his predecessor for 18 centuries was but a quack. To the ecclesiastical physician of today, his predecessor of 50 years ago was a quack. To the every man his own ecclesiastical doctor of when, what will the ecclesiastical physician of today be? Unless evolution, which has been a truth ever since the globe's suns and planets of the solar system were but wandering films of meteor dust, shall reach a limit and become a lie, there is but one fate in store for him. I like that. I like that. Thank you, Mark Twain. Pick up a copy of The Portable Atheist by Christopher Hitchens. Beautiful, wonderful analogy from a great man. And give it out as a human light gift. I'll get to human light in a minute. And so, speaking of that, as people have stepped away, they've started to step away in the United States. This is a long-running spiel ever since the American Religious Identification Survey came out in 2008. Pew and Gallup keep reviewing this. And as they review it, they see that the numbers of nones, the non-affiliated, those who are not affiliated with any particular religious body, is growing. And in a new study called Nones on the Rise, 1 in 5 adults have no religious affiliation, between Pew and PBS's Religion and Ethics News Weekly, it came out saying that 33 million Americans are... Oh, I looked at that wrong. I apologize. Or is it? Yeah, sorry. I take that back. 20% of Americans are unaffiliated. Hooray! But out of that lot, only 13 million are atheists. We have to remember that. Only a small portion of that small portion are atheists. The rest are just unaffiliated. PBS is putting out a series right now called None of the Above. It's a three-part series, and I'll be commenting on it as I see it. But I think you should see it as well. It's going to prove to be interesting. Also, what's interesting, politically, and I think that this shouts out to why it was so vocal at the Democratic National Convention, 67% of the unaffiliated consider themselves to be Democrats. And this year at the Democratic National Convention, if you remember, the Democrats decided to reinsert God or the Creator back into their national platform, and there was a considerable amount of boos. It did it against the voting on the floor, and there was a lot of discontentment. And it's interesting to think that about this, these rise in numbers, because when asked if they are seeking the church that's right for them and they're in between churches, 88% of the unaffiliated replied that they're not seeking a church that's right, quote unquote, right for them. It's really interesting. And the greater analysis and conclusion of this study came out saying that the reason people are leaving religious institutions is because of, quote unquote, inflexible rules and traditional religious centers are too focused on power, money, and politics. So I want to talk about separation of church and state in a minute, but interesting to note that people are leaving the doors of mainline Protestant congregations precisely for the reason that the IRS has a problem with these people, and precisely what these particular 1,400 pastors stood up to on Pulpit Freedom Sunday. So the congregations are getting sick of the politicization of the pulpit. So perhaps it's not standing up and getting media attention to try to claim some greater expansive form of free speech, but it's losing butts in the seats that should sway these pastors to stop politicizing the pulpit. And now moving on to something else. So There was a Newsweek article that came out that had a prominent neurosurgeon, a Harvard professor by the name of Dr. Eben Alexander, saying that while in a coma due to a meningitis infection, he ended up going to heaven. He described a place with people with butterfly wings, clouds, etc., etc. And in the article, he wrote, "Although I considered myself a faithful Christian, I was so more in name than in actual belief. I didn't begrudge those who wanted to believe that Jesus was more than simply a good man who had suffered at the hands of the world. I sympathized deeply with those who wanted to believe that there was a God somewhere out there who loved us unconditionally. In fact, I envied such people the security that those beliefs no doubt provided. But as a scientist, I simply knew better than to believe them myself." Well, after being in a coma for 7 days, he came out with a different opinion. And I think, go to samharris.org. Sam Harris wrote a brilliant response to this. Very pithy, everything we'd expect from Sam Harris. Tells it like it is and wonderfully fun to read. And this also reminds me of another situation that happened, a best-selling book that came out a couple years ago. And that book was called Heaven is for Real. It was by a Christian journalist co-writing with a Christian minister by the name of Todd Burpo. And according to Burpo, his son had some kind of surgery to clean up a burst appendix. And in that time, the son said that he went to heaven and he saw Jesus, yada, yada, yada. And then he came back, told what heaven was like, mentioned a bunch of things about a miscarriage his parents had, about his grandfather he never met, all those little things. And it just has me thinking about this. And what has me thinking about this? A few things. Number one, Christians always seem to go to a Christian heaven. There never seems to be elements of other religions that are involved in their own particular heavenly journey. On top of that, people are convinced that they went to heaven during a time when their brain was zonking out, when it was near death, and then they come back. But we don't know when the brain pieced that bit of experience together. If they're being sincere, then they did experience something, but not necessarily a journey beyond the pearly gates and back, not a day trip to God's country. And so we don't know exactly when the brain pieces this story together. It might piece it together as they're coming back too. It might happen across the time they're unconscious. We don't know when it comes together. But these situations always bear these hallmarks of inconsistency. Inconsistency with reality, that is. They always, like I said, seem to equate to the religion that that person seems to be a part of. In the case of Colton Burpo, Colton Burpo's father, the one who wrote the book, seemed a little more seedy than that. It didn't talk, the book, Heaven is for Real, didn't talk a lot about what heaven is like. It talked a lot about the Burpo family and the trouble they had during a couple years of terrible medical situations. The book basically starts off by Todd Burpo talking about himself and how his small-town Midwest ministerial job wasn't paying the bills. Then he broke his arm. He dealt with some other horrible medical bills that he couldn't pay. And then his son got sick. His appendix burst, and he didn't get to the doctor in time, and he supposedly went to heaven on the operating table. But as Burpo puts in the book, the doctor said he didn't die. It was a routine procedure. And the type of heaven that was portrayed in Heaven is for Real seemed as though it was a kid talking the way that a kid who was a preacher's kid would talk about. He said Jesus was singing kids' Bible songs, that type of thing. And it just seemed as though the kid was coached when he was talking about it, you know? So the family is doing bad financially, and then bam, something comes along, and now they're doing much better. Okay, good. I'm glad they're no longer struggling. But at the same time, you know, it's just terrible that people would just hop on board the superstition train and just feel uplifted that there's a heaven and an afterlife. When we're thinking about a heaven and an afterlife, we're not thinking about life on earth. We don't know if there's a heaven or an afterlife. There probably isn't. But in case there is, we're still living today, and we need to think about today. Today is incredibly important. We have today, tomorrow, and maybe a few tomorrows after that, but not much more. So when the afterlife comes around, perhaps we can slightly prepare for it, but we have work to do while we're on earth, and we have work to do not because we disbelieve in God, but we believe in the people with who we know exist because we live with them. And so, I don't know, at the same time, I didn't like Heaven is for Real. Not because of the content, I just thought it was a poorly written book. And I don't know, I didn't find it that great. But outside of that, the whole premise sucked. And so, moving forward, let's see, I'm trying to find some other good things to talk about. For LGBT news, it was National Coming Out Day. National Coming Out Day, of course, started in 1988 in commemoration with the Second March on Washington in 1987. Also, at that time, we had Bowers versus Hardwick, a case in which, I think that was Bowers versus Hardwick, that was a case which upheld a Georgia homosexual-only sodomy law, and the Supreme Court essentially endorsed discrimination against gays and lesbians, which luckily in 2003, Anthony Kennedy came out and emphatically overruled that previous, I think it was a Warren Berger decision, but Anthony Kennedy came out saying that you can't use the Constitution to moralize against socially disfavored groups. And what it does is it essentially endorses bullying and intimidation of gay and lesbian people by saying you can discriminate against them. And I don't know, I like the idea of National Coming Out Day. I personally came out on National Coming Out Day back in 1996, so that was a long time ago. Anyway, that was in high school. Okay, and now moving forward, onward and upward, as I sometimes say, we have the Ten Commitments. The Ten Commitments, I've been talking about them the last, I guess, every podcast almost. And so far we've talked about altruism, caring for the world around us, critical thinking, empathy, ethical development, global awareness. Now we're at human rights. We just have peace and social justice, responsibility and service and participation next. And I am an advocate for human rights. I'm an advocate for human rights because I'm A, a human being, and B, because I consider myself an altruistic and compassionate human being that cares about other people. And I think human rights are the idea of human rights are perhaps our greatest invention. Our greatest invention, that there is something more outside of us that's based upon us that we uphold and we benefit from. And something that we strive to make unconditional and inalienable, but we don't always get there. And so I want to think about human rights, and I want you guys to think about human rights. I want you guys to think about human rights as these idea of a set of inalienable rights possessed by members in a species rather than qualities exhibited. I write that because if you're part of the human club, regardless of mental capacity or merit of any type of other merit, just by genetics, you are imbued with these ideas of rights. And it's interesting to note that other animals, cetaceans, pachyderms, some dogs, some crows, ravens, have these von Economo neurons, and also other primates have these von Economo neurons that aid in perspective taking and aid in certain self-sacrificial altruistic acts of pro-social behavior. And it's interesting to note, as we've developed these concepts of human rights, what we started off with was this idea of creatures of reason, creatures able to plan, to take the perspective of others in accordance with executing their action, and thus stepping above basic, I guess you could say, baser animal instincts, like Freud would say, murder, incest, and cannibalism. And so we had this idea of creatures of reason. And so I think it's been better defined over the last 100 years for creatures of a perspective of mind and moral capability. So moral agents, those who are morally culpable for their actions. And this is a wide subject. This is a wide subject because that implies free will to a large extent. If you're culpable for your actions, you've had a choice over them. We've designed a system around trying the individual rather than trying the system. And yet we have a lot of effect on the person from where they've come from. And Philip Zimbardo, in an interview in a book called A Very Bad Wizard, talks about this. And Zimbardo basically says there's a study in which we take people leaving prison and we remove them from their neighborhood. We don't exclude them from contacting their old friends and family, but we remove them from the neighborhood. We give them a job and a steady source of income and a nice roof over their head. And there's very little rates of recidivism. And so if we look at this, we get this idea that these ideas of morality, of being a moral agent, of being a creature of reason, they have sort of been replaced. And so we also have these ideas that human rights are conferred on all humans, and that's just by virtue of being a member of Homo sapiens sapiens. And it's not even having potentials towards cognition, because you could have a brain-impaired fetus or a person who lost a large section of their brain and will be in a persistent vegetative state, yet they are still afforded human rights. And so we have this interesting idea where other animals with higher levels of cognition, of action, and perspective-taking than those with inhibited brains are afforded less recognition and rights. So human rights are afforded specifically upon genetic membership. And maybe we should rethink that a little bit on how we afford those rights. Not necessarily saying that we should remove human rights from other human beings, but perhaps extend them at least in some degree to other animals. Whales, for example, have a protection of whales because we can communicate with them. They have perspective-taking abilities. They bear empathy. Look up Franz de Waal on this, brilliant scholar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But moving forward to looking at rights themselves, there are positive, natural, and civil rights I want to look at. Positive rights, as in, or positive laws, I should say, not in the sense of affirming laws, but those posited, put out there by people. Natural rights, that's one that's big, that we have these conferred natural rights from an external source. But I disagree with that. I don't think we have quote-unquote natural rights or natural law. Not to essentialize it too much. If that were the case, it would be mostly inviolable. But it's frankly not. H.L.A. Hart, the jurist H.L.A. Hart, said that there are no natural, he's a positivist, and there are no natural rights, but something similar to that. And it comes down to the fact that even the strongest person has to sleep sometime. And then I want to move forward into the idea of civil rights, these rights which we expand upon. These are generally expansive rather than regressive. In one case, we had Proposition 8, and that was a regressive law, a change in the state constitution to take marriage extension of official marriage status, state marriage status to same-sex couples, it removed that rather than expanded on it. And so civil rights extend from natural rights, yet they're more difficult to argue against when it comes to different cultural contexts. And so looking at these civil rights and these ideas of natural rights, we look at things like the social contract and what we can't do to one another. In social contract theory, the idea is we set up so we have a known and impartial judge to decide between conflicts between two individuals, and then we expand beyond that. And then from that, we develop a more sophisticated social structure. And looking at two that emerged about the same time from essentially a parallel sociological political framework were the Bill of Rights of the United States and the Declaration on Rights of Man and Citizen from France. And in that, we have positive rights coming out of the Bill of Rights, and negative rights coming out of the Bill of Rights, and positive rights coming out of the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen. In the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen of France, what we have there, we have Rousseau, and Rousseau's in the mix with the general will. And Rousseau says in the book On the Social Contract, Rousseau says that none of us are born equal in strength, speed, and intelligence, and we come together to be lifted to equality. In the United States, on the other hand, we have an idea of negative rights. Our rights are not something the government gives us, but something that the government cannot do to us. So in a sense, in the United States, in France, you're free to something, but in the U.S., you're free from something. And so these came from this idea that we're creatures of reason, and the human rights that came out of being creatures of reason were more outside of life. It was more cerebral. Concepts of liberty, concepts, pursuit of happiness, property rights, more cerebral. But today, I think we're more aspirational, and we're starting to generate human rights as more substantial than cerebral. And I'll get to that in just a second. But human rights, as I said earlier, looking at H.L.A. Hart, I agree with him that it's a construction of people. And human rights are not necessarily guaranteed, but there's something incredibly valuable to aspire towards. They're one of the most valuable things to aspire towards. And even though they're not necessarily inviolable and not guaranteed, we can at least constantly be stewards to ensure that they're there almost all the time, if not 100% of the time. One great example of this is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, of course, the founding charter of the United Nations. And I like it especially because it's not about international rights of nations. It's rights of people within those national boundaries. And it set up a system or an aspirational system in which people would have these rights regardless and before parochial provincial laws of different nations. And so I want to look at this a little bit further as well. And I want to maybe instead talk about them as cherished rights. And the previous cherished rights, the long-standing ones, were things like the right to life, that life cannot be taken away from you without due process of law. That's another thing in human rights. Having a rule of law, I would say, would be considered a human right. Not to have arbitrary authority, but to have something grounded in the rule of law. And another one of these is thought, conscience, and ideology. In our Bill of Rights, that happens to be the First Amendment right there, the conscience clauses. And then beyond that, with that, I guess I should say, we have the freedom of expression, the freedom from torture, the freedom from involuntary servitude, that's slavery and less than slavery, but still involuntary servitude, the right to due process, rule of law, and equality before the law with an impartial arbiter. These ideas to protect us in a cerebral sense and how we feel. But at the same time now, because we have so many resources and we have such a manner and method in which we could distribute them, we should consider that anything below a minimum standard of living is shameful and it should be sought after for remedy in the most efficient ways and manner possible. And so moving beyond the cerebral rights, we have these other ones, such as internet and communication. Because today, in a modern world, not having access to the internet, you don't have to use the internet. You don't have to be on your iPhone. You don't have to chat online 20 hours a day. You don't have to play World of Warcraft. But it seems to be socially crippling to not have access to the internet. It seems to provide such an undue social advantage to those who have access to the internet. Business is done on the internet. Education now is being increasingly done on the internet. Speaking to family and friends around the globe, internet. Access to information, internet. And yet, governments are now clamping down on things they don't like on the internet. And I think that the internet is sort of a sign that that these regional governments are sort of dying out, because we have more of a popular sovereignty emerging via the internet. And I think there should be some semblance of balance to have a rule of law and a particular social order in place so we don't have necessarily mob rule happening. But at the same time, I think that having access to communicating with other people these days, it may not have been before when we didn't have the level of technology, but as long as the level of technology is where it is, and considering it's so socially crippling to not have access to the internet, I think having the internet, having access to the internet, a free and open internet, I think we should put that up as a cherished right. On top of that, and education, it's socially crippling, both locally and globally, not to have a basic set of information that we can all work with, a basic set of instruction in math, in science, in literacy, and the basic tools to further pursue that later. So I would say education should be a human right. And on top of that, because of the level of technology, this level of sophistication of technology that we're at today, and considering how crippling it is, how socially crippling it is not to have access to water and food, to have that level of gross poverty is global gross negligence, to have people starving while we have I don't want to go partisan. I can't go partisan. Actually, I was doing a yay gay person type of thing in the LGBT moment, and I cut it out because I didn't want to be partisan, so I'm going to stop. I'm rambling, but I was going to make a particular example, but it's ridiculous when we have people buying, you know, $10 million homes. Nothing wrong with that, but as long as there's that type of acrid poverty around the globe, it should be unconscionable for someone to buy a $10 million home for themselves with that level of acrid poverty around the globe. Go buy a $3 million house and go buy everyone in Kenya lunch for the day, for Christ's sake, you know? And we even have poverty in America. How shameful is that? How shameful is that when we have people doing these political ideologies in which we celebrate, I shouldn't say celebrate, or at least we overlook children losing health insurance for the sake of people who make quite a bit of money having a little extra money. And that little extra money could more than go towards, you know, children's health insurance. On top of that, this whole idea that we are against a single-payer system when we have so much resources, it's just wrong. It's a social disease when we have so little citizenship and community pride that we would allow these things to happen it's a social disease. It's morally reprehensible. And a lot of this coming from these Christians who read a book about a guy who preached to giving away all of your every last possession, holding big megachurch congregations, becoming multi-million, if not billionaires, preaching a gospel of poverty. And it's unspeakable how they see their fellow people for the sake of getting a little bit more, you know. And then finally, I guess the next couple, Europe did this, the European Union, you know, maybe this is one reason they deserve the Nobel Peace Prize. They declared leisure a right. Leisure. That's unthinkable in the United States, declaring leisure a right. How terrible is that? That, A, leisure has to be declared a right in order to uphold it, but the fact that it would be unconscionable to do that in the United States. In Europe, they get, 16 weeks of paid vacation. You're lucky if you get a longer lunch break here, for Christ's sake, you know? So, leisure. Let leisure be a right. We're human beings, damn it. We're not just pack animals slaving in the fields anymore as little herd groups. Not to slam agriculture, but it's insane that Europe, A, has to declare leisure a right when it should be a given, and B, it's not even on the table here. You know? And these ideas about other rights of communication in the workforce. In Germany, there is a law that there has to be a certain percentage of the working people in a corporation on the board. We don't have that here. We have laws that basically say that a company has to do everything in its power to maximize the profits for their shareholders, but nothing that says that they have to listen to their workers. I think it's damn time for something like that. It's damn time to start retrofitting the system for its excesses that happened in the ignorance of people, of our fellow human beings. It's time to re-inject the system with a dose of proud to be a citizen of the world, a citizen of your country. Not just someone who bought their way out of the system. I got mine. Atlas shrugged and gave us all the finger. Screw that. I don't want to live in that world. I don't want to live in a world in which we have these ideas that people are being exploited, but they're pointing the finger at the wrong people. Yeah, guess what, Tea Party? You're right. You're being exploited. Yeah, there are people taking advantage of you. But it's not the poor. No, not in the least. It is not the poor that's taking advantage of you. It's the Koch brothers. People who started the Tea Party movement with their money, sort of refunneling under a failed campaign, hiring people to look like the local concerned citizen to rile local outrage and umbrage, and bam, right then and there, you have the people who are the parasites. Not just predatory capitalism, but parasitic capitalism, setting it up, doing all the bad things that they blame the poor for. The true welfare queen lives with a fucking golden throne, you know? Lives with the wealth of a queen, not some poor person of color in a project, but some poor little rich girl off in some castle. That's who's exploiting us. That's who paid, bought. That our government was bought and sold long ago, and we don't even think these things, that leisure is a right. They used to think that leisure was a right in the United States. Hell, the United States, we started Labor Day. It was the 1st of May. You know, now it's still celebrated in communist countries. But we started Labor Day. We gave the world child labor laws. We gave the world the 40-hour work week. We gave the world the weekend. And yet, we've gone far, far away from that. Perhaps leisure should be our human right that we stand up for. Because with leisure, it comes with a lot of other good things. perhaps we wouldn't be so psychologically screwed up in this country if we didn't see leisure as maybe a gift, but something we are owed. We should not be working as hard as we are, and perhaps it's time to finally do something about it. Not just bitch about 99% versus the 1%. Bitch about those who actually get to take time off versus those who are essentially slaves. But then again, maybe that goes back to the earlier cherished rights of freedom from involuntary servitude. And, you know, in a sense, the Constitution generally focuses on government acts, not private actor, private actor. But perhaps if the government is giving such endorsement to these corporations, which used to have sundown clauses, perhaps we can stand up and say, well, since it's a constitutional issue when the churches do something when it has government endorsement, well, perhaps we should consider that for these corporate laws and rethink how the corporations have taken advantage of the system and step up and say, no more involuntary servitude. We demand leisure. We demand internet. We demand a basic standard. We demand food programs, food stamp programs with funds that keep up with living food costs, modern food costs, not $4.29 a day. You starve, you get fat, you starve. Congratulations. And then also, I guess the last one, and this is one that encompasses a lot of things about social discrimination. I think a human right is equal access to civic participation. Quite a humanistic ideal that we should not be divided amongst ourselves based upon sex, skin color, sexual orientation, ability status, etc., etc. So I guess in this, maybe we should expand. We should take a moral lead again. We should do more than just the weekend. We should give ourselves at least a month of paid vacation. And I don't know. I think that needs to be right. It just strikes me that a lot of our problems stem from us neglecting these ideas with each other. And it just makes me mad because I, in my everyday, try to recognize other people as human beings and recognize their rights. It's not just common courtesy, you know. It's something that should be at the fundamental core of our being. Perhaps I was raised right by my parents and grandparents in the Midwest to think of other people as people and to take into account their needs too. And I guess that's a central core of the humanist philosophy as well. And so, I don't know. I just kind of ramble for a bit. I just get angry sometimes. I'm angry right now. I'm having trouble finding a job. And, you know, if the system were a little bit better, maybe the economy would be better. And I don't know. And regardless of my own situation, I would be standing up for these issues for other people as well. And I think it's contingent upon all of us to stand up to say leisure is something that we find to be a cherished value. The internet access to the internet is something we find to be a cherished value. Food, nutritional food, clean water, we have plenty of it, and we find it to be a cherished value. So we started off with these ideas of natural rights, which later were changed by H.L.A. Hart to that of even the strongest man must sleep sometimes, so therefore they're a human invention. But they're a goddamn good invention. And there's something that I think is probably the best thing we've ever come up with. These ideas of inviolable rights of people we cannot violate or should not violate, even though they're often violated. And also, these ideas went from having more cerebral rights to now more modern substantive rights. And we've fallen far behind in terms of leading the world, in terms of things like the weekend, in terms of things like a basic social security. And then lastly, perhaps we should change the idea of human rights of I'm entitled to a bare bones number of things and just be unsatisfied unless 99.999, because I don't know if we can reach everybody, but 99.99999% of the world can have some basic standard of living that would not that we would not cry tears of agony if our pets in the United States were forced to live under those conditions. And so perhaps we should change the idea of human rights to human flourishing. And I don't know how we're going to get there, but let's examine it. What do you guys think? I rambled quite a bit, but I just get angry sometimes. And I just find it painful when we think about other people who have to work three or four jobs, or, you know, people who can't even find one job who want to work. When we think about the fact that we have people with such opulence right now who the system really benefited either by a long-term hereditary system where there was a reduction in capital gains, blah, 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 inheritance, blah, 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 or people just got really lucky, but they're not necessarily giving back because they're afraid themselves and it's risky to give back. But you know what? I think that our fellow human beings are someone who's worth investing in. And sure, some people may take advantage of the system, but most won't. Most people want to step up. Most people want to work. One of the reasons the New Deal was so great, and Roosevelt, the quote from Roosevelt's on his memorial in D.C., it was essentially that though these jobs may not produce that much of a useful physical benefit, the moral benefit of people being able to work and show a product of their labor was worth it just to get the country back together after a Great Depression. And so I don't agree with this idea that everyone's going to take advantage of about a free ride. I think that people want to work. I think that inherently we all feel a sense of pride that we can do something and we have something to do. And even if it's, you know, sewing a basket together or painting a wall or something, just being able to do something, show the product of your work, and then take home a couple bucks, you know, that's worthwhile. We have too many underemployed and too many unemployed people right now, and I think what would really help our country is just some more bullshit jobs, honestly, right now. We need another TVA. We need another New Deal. And I think being considered, I guess maybe that's the ultimate one, being considered should be one of our core human rights as well. Not being ignored, being considered. And so I'm rambling at this point, but I'm just really angry right now. And I apologize if I went, you know, all over the place, but those are just my thoughts. And I'm just not happy with the way things are. Well, anyway, I wanted to go over some of the things we're going to be doing coming up because I'm almost at an hour and I wanted to keep this below an hour. So we're doing our book club. Tomorrow night we're doing The Freethinker's Textbook by Charles Bradlaugh. Next month we're doing Leviathan and Social Contract, Hobbes and Rousseau. Then for December we're ending with Why I'm Not a Christian and Why I'm Not a Muslim. And those are the first and third Tuesday nights at the Bamboo Lounge in Tea Deli, 1469 University. This Sunday, I'm giving a lecture followed by a 45-minute lecture followed by 45 to an hour of discussion on logical fallacies. I'm going to show clips of Richard Dawkins and Bill O'Reilly debating on Fox News to show inductive versus deductive reasoning and to pick out the logical fallacies. Also, coming up on the 2nd, join us. We're going to be with the San Diego Coalition of Reason down at the Light the Night Walk on Friday, November 2nd. Please go out and vote on Tuesday the 6th. Please vote. Please vote. And tell all your friends to vote too. And on top of that, on the 11th of November, we have Edwina Rogers of the Secular Coalition for America. She's speaking at the Point Loma Library on that Sunday the 11th at 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. And in later in November, the third Sunday, we're having our annual Free Thought Family Thanksgiving. We'll be showing Blasphemous Holiday clips, and we're going to have a potluck and play games. It's going to be fantastic. So please come out. I want to get at least 100 people to this. And then for December, we are doing our annual membership meeting with our board elections. We're also going to be having Human Light, and Sam Singleton is the host. And I am finalizing a venue, and we will be hosting Atheist Experience Matt Dillahunty on Saturday, January 12th, around 7 p.m., and I'm putting something together to finalize that. So thank you for listening today. I hope you enjoyed it. I kind of went a little bit all over the place because, I don't know, I just kind of rambled. I guess maybe it'll be good. I don't know. I'm going to listen to it nonetheless. Well, I hope you really enjoyed this as much as I enjoyed recording it. And so, yeah, I look forward to seeing you at our upcoming meetings, and have a great Monday night. This has been a production of the Humanist Association of San Diego.